Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Somewhere out there is a little girl or boy thinking, when I grow up, I want to work with dead people. Certainly that was the case with Carla, a volunteer who wanted to be a mortician since the age of 9. Not only that, Carla runs a dating site for people with jobs similar to hers and is the author of Past Mortems, Life and Death Behind Mortuary Doors. Carla, good afternoon to you.
Hello, hi.
So you were 9, was it when you first thought you'd like to be a mortician, or was it earlier than that?
Slightly earlier, when I sort of had the desire to be working in the field of biology, and I think it was by the time I was about 9, I knew what a mortician was, and that was when, you know, my mum asked me what I wanted to be, and I said a mortician, obviously to her shock and horror.
And you used to kind of have, when you were a kid, you used to have fake funerals and stuff for roadkill.
Common thing actually for children. I do sort of mention this in the book, like, not to be worried if you have children and they start to have funerals for dead animals and things, because children suddenly become aware of their mortality at a certain age. So it's quite common for, you know, kids to be interested. And it wasn't just me on my own, my friends were interested as well. But I think I obviously continued with that sort of morbid curiosity and then made it my career, whereas they went off and did, you know, more normal jobs, I guess.
Yes. And so you went to become an anatomical pathology technologist.
That's right, yeah.
What does that involve?
So basically, that involves me working in a mortuary. APTs run the mortuary, and when an autopsy is carried out by the pathologist, it's actually us that remove all the organs from the deceased, and then we remove the samples, for example, for forensics or toxicology, and then we reconstruct the deceased afterwards, make them viewable for family members, and then deal with the families and things like that.
Right. How much do you take out, or does it depend what they died from?
To be honest, most postmortems have the same routine, because the best thing is to look at absolutely every organ, because you don't want to miss anything. If we do remove anything, it's tiny pieces of tissue that get sent to histology, and it's usually with permission from the coroner, and the family are aware of it as well.
Right. So if once you've taken out all those bits, how big of a lump of material is that?
A lot of organs that are packed within to our body cavity, very much like, you know, those plastic anatomical models that you see, everything fits together like a perfect jigsaw. So when we take all that out, we are left with quite a big cavity. And then once the organs have been looked at by the pathologist, we pop them all into what we call a viscera bag, which is a sort of biodegradable plastic bag. And they go back into the cavity, and then we sew them back up again. And you can't really tell that anything's been taken out at all.
Right, but you don't have to put the organs back where they were precisely or anything.
It's it's not possible. It's like trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together. I sort of talk about that in my book in the reconstruction chapter. You know, you can only really do so much. We make sure that the person looks dignified and has everything back within them, but we can't really put it all exactly in the right place.
And when you've taken out all that viscera, the human body must kind of collapse a fair bit.
Well, the ribs keep everything very rigid, if you think of it like that.
It's yeah.
Very much like a sort of basket, if you see what I mean. And we you know, insert some cotton wool, absorbent materials, things like that, to ensure that there's no leakage and to fill out any, you know, what might look like a bit of a hollow. And then obviously once the organs have gone back in again, it just all looks perfectly normal.
Right. Did you ever, even when you started this, did you ever have a, you know, kind of vom reaction to it?
I think if I, you know, I wanted to do it from so young, and was very interested in biology as a child. So I don't think that, you know, I think for me it was a calling, and I knew that I'd be okay doing it. I did take my year out to be an embalmer's assistant at funeral directors, just to make sure that I was okay with the deceased. And I was absolutely fine the first time I ever saw anybody, you know, deceased. It wasn't an issue at all for me.
Yeah. Is it fun? I mean, you're in a room where presumably there's loads of dead bodies that are kind of inside, you know, shelves or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, can you kind of play the radio and sing along to music and that kind of thing? Or do you have to kind of maintain a certain atmosphere when you're doing all this?
When we do coronial and, you know, post-mortems, which are the most routine post-mortems, we can absolutely listen to the radio. You know, we might chat with the pathologist about what we've been up to at the weekend. Never anything undignified. You know, it's very normal, because if you think about it, if you're doing the same thing every single day, it does become quite normal. And provided we're respectful to the patients that we have, yeah, we can pop the radio on, you know, listen to the news, listen to some CDs, and have a bit of chatter. Very different with a forensic postmortem, because there's an awful lot of police in the room, and it's quite quiet because the pathologist is talking to the police officers and things like that. So that's a little bit different.
Somebody wants to know, what's the difference between an autopsy and a postmortem?
There isn't really one. The terms are interchangeable, really.
And you know, from movies, I suppose you always have this view that, you know, there's a kind of a row of like big drawers, and you pull it out, and there's a body there, and the body is always completely straight. Is that because I imagine if you died by being hit by a car, you'd die with your arms up, going.
The deceased can end up in all sorts of positions. And the thing is, rigor mortis doesn't actually, you know, that's obviously the stiffening of the body, doesn't really set fully until 12 to 24 hours maybe 36 hours. So there is a little bit of time where the deceased can be repositioned. But obviously, if rigor mortis is set in, then it can be a little bit more difficult if someone's not been found for a couple of days and they've died, you know, in a chair, for example. So, and we don't have fridges like they show on the TV where they have all the separate doors, you know, the little metal doors. We tend to have big white units, and they've got lots of trays in there, so there's a bit more room. So then that way, if someone is in a funny position, there's a lot more room for them to move around.
And if somebody does die in a funny position, is there a method for straightening them out?
You can do so. It takes a bit of force, and if it's not necessary, then we wouldn't do it. It's only if, for example, we need to examine, say, a cut on the inside of a thigh, and we might need to sort of lever them apart slightly. But for the most part, we'll just do what we need to do. And if there's going to be a family viewing, for example, we might try and straighten them out as well, just so they don't look so strange, in the viewing.
That's the thing. I mean, it's probably... Everybody in Ireland, anyway, has some story about some great aunt who died in a seat, and then they laid her out in the coffin, and then she sprang up during the middle of the wake, you know, and frightened the life out of everybody.
Lots of urban legends.
Yes, but you wouldn't have to, like, you know, pin it down to the body, down to the coffin or anything, to make sure that didn't happen.
No, not at all, because the thing about rigor mortis is as bodies begin to putrefy and autolyse, and, you know, the natural decomposition process, rigor mortis stops after around 30-ish hours. So the body becomes what we call, it has secondary flaccidity. So it basically becomes very flaccid, very, you know, soft and malleable. So that shouldn't happen, but, you know, it's one of those urban legends, I think.
Right, okay. Now, the bodies that come in, are they... for want of a better term, relatively fresh? Or do you occasionally get a body in that's, you know, a person who's been dead for a long time, and there might be other living things there, like maggots and the like?
Yeah. I mean, I devoted a whole chapter in my book to this, actually, because it's a lot more common than you might think. You know, sadly, people pass away and they don't have any family members or friends, and neighbours will only become aware of it because of the smell. You know, that's a very typical scenario. The police will break the door down and the deceased will be there, and unfortunately they're sort of like 2 weeks into decomposition. Or people who try, you know, commit suicide, they go outside into the woods, things like that, and then they're found by the proverbial man walking a dog. It's a very common occurrence, particularly in the summer as well. And, you know, maggots and flies, and, you know, there's a whole ecosystem involved that you just sort of have to ignore and crack on with what you're doing, really, to make sure that you do a good job.
Yeah. I mean, and how plentiful can the maggots be?
Oh, God, millions of them, millions. I think, I mean, I describe in the book about how they make a sort of Rice Krispie pop underneath your Wellington boots on the floor, you know. They can get absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. Well, in that instance, what you don't want, if there's a wake and there's an open cart, you don't want maggots suddenly appearing. So how do you have to hoover them out of the body, or what do you do?
Matt, but we wouldn't have an open casket or anything for a deceased like that. We'd have to inform the family, unfortunately, and just say it's just an impossibility, because even the embalmers can't kind of reverse those natural changes, you know. So yeah, it would definitely have to be one of those sort of screw down coffin affairs.
No, I must say, personally, I find all this kind of thing fascinating. But for someone in your line of work, and other people you know in this line of work, can it be difficult getting a date once people learn what it is you do?
Yes, sort of. I think what I noticed as an APT full-time sort of 8 to 10 years was that the only people that I'd really end up dating were undertakers or, you know, people that I came across during my day, because obviously they can understand it. If you're in a club and somebody comes over and tries to chat you up and you say that you're a mortician, then, you know, that separates the men from the boys, definitely.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of people on this website that you've started. Ooh. Dead Meat.
Yeah.
It's obviously M-E-E-T.
Yeah.
And they've found similar that they can't, you know, it's more difficult to get a date with someone who doesn't work in the industry.
Yeah, I think so. I think what's good about Dead Meat is I always call it a dating and networking site. So it's a little bit like a LinkedIn as well. But I think it's like if you work in this industry and you tend to see the same undertakers over and over again, you know, you think, well, what other undertakers are out there? You know, is there anybody else that I could, you know, or an embalmer that I might be able to have a date with? And then you don't have that awkwardness at the beginning of having to explain what you do, because obviously both of you are in the same boat. So
yeah,
that was really where the idea came from. I just thought, wouldn't it be great if you could just get all that out of the way and then just start, you know, a proper date. So that's, yeah, that was the idea behind Dead Meat.
Okay, so I assume that, you know, it has probably happened to you and a lot of people that you say what it is you do and you get a kind of slightly iffy response, but
yeah,
you must have at some point got a response of, God, that's interesting, and then plied you with questions for hours.
Well, the problem is, if I'm at parties or dinner parties and things like that and people ask me what I do and I say what I do, then I become the focus of attention and I feel terrible because, you know, I'm not the guest of honour, and I notice that then people around having conversations will start to listen to my conversation. So sometimes I'll just try and not really mention it. Otherwise, you're right. I mean, people are absolutely fascinated, and especially when I'm at a hairdresser's or something, you know. That's what my hairdresser wants to talk about. She doesn't want to talk about where I went on holiday or anything like that.
That's because she's found a maggot in your hair and she wants to know where it came from.
Yeah, so, you know, and then everybody else starts listening in as well from the other chairs. Like, oh, I watch Silent Witness. Is it like that? You know, and it's definitely more of a topic of interest now than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
Now, one award, just so the listeners know, that Carla got was the Grenfell Coffins Award. That's a real award for a major contribution to the understanding of death. And it is something we've spoken about before on the program, kind of an idea of, talking more openly about death and not it not being a taboo subject. Carla, do you have any thoughts about when you die, what kind of a funeral you'd like or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge advocate of making sure that we do talk about death and we plan ahead. And for me, I'm an organ donor for a start. So, because obviously there's lots of different things that you can do. You can donate to medical science, but you can't do that if you're an organ donor. So you sort of have to make a choice. And then when it's, you know, my time to go, hopefully people will use my organs. And then I'd have a green funeral, which is becoming more popular now. So a green burial, basically, I wouldn't be in a coffin. I'd probably be wrapped in linen, buried in a green funeral sort of park area, and have a tree planted over me, really. And that would be my way of, you know, giving back to the earth.
Yeah. Now, when you say a park, would you have to get a special permission to be buried in a park?
There are special burial grounds that are, that are sort of called like woodland burials and, you know, park burials, but they're actually licensed burial grounds. And the families can have a much more hands-on, sort of funeral. They can choose the songs, you know, and it's a bit more like the way civil ceremonies for weddings have become popular. Now these green funerals are becoming popular as well. And it's not environmentally detrimental, you see. You know, embalming chemicals, they're detrimental to the environment. Cremation can be. But if you just pop me in soil and let me rot naturally, let the maggots eat me, let a tree grow, that is the way that you give back to the earth.
Do you think the family should choose the songs, or you should leave instructions what the song should be, given that you're dead, so it doesn't make any difference what they play?
I'll probably leave instructions, and it won't be the typical things, you know. Maybe it'll probably just be things that I really, you know, enjoy listening to now, or maybe something really spooky, like I'll be watching you.
I'd like to play Who's Sorry Now at my funeral, just to make everybody feel better. The one question that's been texted in the most, Carla, is do corpses fart?
Sometimes, yes, it has to be said. Farts or burps or slight groans, and it's all to do with the gases that build up during the putrefaction process.
Oh, I was ready for farts and burps, but slight groans?
Yes, because obviously when the gas escapes through the sort of the larynx and the voice box, you can end up with a bit of a groan. So, yeah, a couple of zombie worry moments there, but you learn to get used to it.
Carla, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That's Carla Valentine. The name of her book is Past Mortems, Life and Death Behind Mortuary Doors. She's now the technical curator of the Barts Pathology Museum in London. Moncrief.
with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big cheque for the delivery guy? GasNetworks.ie/movetogas.